Just while you're talking, do please reach behind you for a Bible and be turning up pages 236, 7, and 8. Maybe just start with 236. And then you'll see the passages that we'll be looking at this morning. And in a little while, Mike's going to come and read it to us. Actually, I have to say, once every 4 years, I suffer a bout of insomnia around this time of year. Have we got any Australians in? Oh. Well, wait, congratulations on your impending victory in the first Ashes test. So if you see me nodding off during my own sermon, which would be a first, then that's why. It's always a triumph of hope over expectation because, you know, rather like Liverpool in the Championship, they never quite make it, in, you know, when they're in Australia. You should let the hope go. That's what I say to Liverpool fans, let it go, let the hope go. Let it go. All right, Mike's going to come and read to us.
So we're reading about Gideon, chapter 6, verses 1 to 16, and then we're flipping the page, and we're reading chapter 7, 1 to 21. Page 236. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count them, all their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians, and I delivered you from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them out before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live. But you have not listened to me." The angel of the Lord came down and sat under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a winepress to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and I will strike down all the Midianites together." And you will strike down all the Midianites together. Over to chapter 7, verse 1. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp at Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Morah. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men. I cannot deliver Midian into your hands, or Israel would boast about against me. My own strength has saved me. Now announce to the army, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 20,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them out for you there. If I say this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 of them lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the others go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up, go down against the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they are saying. Afterwards, you'll be encouraged to attack the camp." So he and Purah, his servants, went down to the outposts of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern peoples were settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand of the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. "I had a dream," he was saying. "A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tents with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed." His friend responded, "This can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands." When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he bowed down and worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, "Get up! The Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands." Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them, with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all round the camp blow yours and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle of watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets and broke their jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." While each man held his position round the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike. It's a long old passage. Any guesses? Who's that? Underdog. You see, you would have had to have told me that was Underdog. That passed me by as a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. But anyway, Underdog. This is what Wikipedia says. Underdog was an American animated television series that ran from 1964 until 1973. Hands up if you recognised who it was. You're not that old. You're not that old. I don't remember it being on UK television at all. Anyway, 124 episodes, apparently. And this was the premise. The premise was that humble and lovable Shoeshine Boy, a cartoon dog, was in truth the superhero Underdog. When villains threatened, Shoeshine Boy ducked into a telephone booth where he transformed into the caped and costumed hero, destroying the booth in the process when his superpowers were activated. Underdog almost always spoke in rhyme. "When help is needed, I am not slow. It's hip, 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 and away I go." Underdog's most frequent saying when he appeared was, "There's no need to fear. Underdog is here." The majority of episodes He used a common final scene. That is probably the most lame final scene in cartoon history. A crowd of people looking up into the sky would say, "Look in the sky. It's a plane. It's a bird." After this, an old woman wearing glasses would say, "It's a frog." I told you it was lame. Another onlooker would say, "A frog?" An underdog would say, "Not plane, not bird, not even frog. It's just little old me."
Underdog,
exactly right. Underdog usually caused collateral damage. Whenever someone complained about the damage, he replied, "I am a hero who never fails. I cannot be bothered with such details." We Brits, we love an underdog. When an unfancied team is up against a giant of the game, everyone roots for the little guy. In 1992, Denmark won the European Football Championships. So case in point, they were only in the tournament because another team had dropped out, but they went on to win it. The other team, I forget who it was, but Diana will tell you afterwards. You're not still sore, Diana, are you? Just slightly. Okay. You see, when I was younger, you always cheered for anyone playing Pete Sampras or Steffi Graf at tennis because you knew they were very unlikely to win. These days, I want anyone facing the All Blacks at rugby to win, even if they're Welsh. The Lord of the Rings only works as a drama because everyone wants the little guy to win, to get the ring into the fires at Mordor. It wouldn't have worked so well if Frodo had been an expert soldier. And today's story seems the ultimate underdog story. Here is a man, have a look at Judges 6 and 7. Here is a man who we see hiding away, who defeats his enemies with a few men. Who would have thought this fearful, weak man would have destroyed the army that had been plaguing Israel for 7 years? So he's an underdog. Is that what's going on here? Well, look, two things from this story. Firstly, God chooses someone odd. And secondly, God supplies the victory. So God chooses someone odd. Look at verse 11 of chapter 6 with me. Gideon is hiding. Now he's threshing wheat. Has anyone here threshed wheat? I imagine you do it mechanically these days, but has anyone actually threshed wheat? No, okay, we're all metropolitan city dwellers. So threshing wheat is the process where you separate the grain of wheat, as I understand it, from the husk of wheat. And you do it outdoors because the husk is lighter than the grain. So I don't know quite how it works, but I think you throw it all up in the air and the husk blows away and the grain falls down. And that's how you do it. You don't do it in a wine press underground because there's no breeze. It doesn't work. But that's where Gideon's doing it. He's afraid. Why? Because of the Midianites. They're going to come and wipe out the crops. He's also weak. Look at verse 15 with me. His clan is the weakest in his tribe, and he's the weakest in his family. God calls him to fight the Midianites, but he doesn't get suddenly brave. Look at verse 10 of chapter 7. He's afraid to attack the Midianites, so God lets him have a preview as to what they're thinking. Now, why does God choose someone like Gideon to fight an army? 2 weeks ago, we were looking at the story of Samson. Samson goes actively looking for a fight, but not Gideon. He doesn't seem like much of a military leader. He looks like a complete underdog. So God chooses someone odd. Secondly, God supplies the victory. Look at verse 14 of chapter 6. "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" Gideon doesn't have much strength, but God tells him to use that strength that he has. Not the strength he doesn't have. Just use that strength he has and to save Israel. God is sending him. God will have the victory. Verse 16, "The Lord answered, 'I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive.'" God promises Gideon he will be victorious. But the key thing is this really odd passage in the first 8 verses of chapter 7. I don't know if you've ever read this before. It's quite a common Bible story. But if you don't, it's very peculiar. Look at chapter 7, first 8 verses. Gideon starts with an army of 32,000 people. It looks like it's pretty heavily outnumbered by the Midianites, because verse 12 tells us they were thick as locusts, and their camels were so many they couldn't be counted. But at least 32,000 is some sort of army. God then tells Gideon to get rid of the people too afraid to fight. And 32,000 becomes 10,000. Fewer and fewer people to take on this vast army of Midian. It's looking unlikely. And then there's this weird, weird final test to work out who will fight. And it concerns this random thing of how the men will drink water. And as a result of this weird and random test, 10,000 becomes 300, just about enough to guard the bags. And it's ridiculous. How are they going to beat an army, and why did they have to be reduced in this way? Well, verse 2 of chapter 7 gives us the answer. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men. I cannot deliver Midian into their hands, or Israel will boast against me. My own strength has saved me." God wants there to be no doubt. The victory has nothing to do with Gideon's leadership or his fighting skill or the skill of his men. The victory is God's and God's alone. It is to be achieved by God and not man. What can we learn from this? Well, firstly, God can use any of us. God uses all sorts of people to do his bidding. Think of all the Old Testament stories. Moses was sent to plead the Israelites' case before Pharaoh. It's a story close to my heart because I suffered with a stammer for many years. Moses was sent to plead the Israelites' case before Pharaoh despite having a speech impediment. David stepped up to kill Goliath despite being a shepherd boy. The gospel was spread by a ragtag group of fishermen, tax collectors, and zealots. What does this tell us? Well, God is not bothered that we don't feel up to scratch or that we're not particularly good at stuff. He still uses us. Darren read this passage out last week, but it bears repetition. This is from 1 Corinthians 1. "Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify, to kind of destroy, to sort of make nothing, the things that are, so that no one can boast before him." So if you follow Jesus and you don't think you have too much to offer, be encouraged. Gideon was the least in his family, and the clan was the weakest in his tribe. Moses was sent to speak with a ruler of the land when speaking was the one thing he couldn't do. David was too small for the standard soldier's armor when he went to fight Goliath. Now, God may choose to use our strengths. If you can make nice food, make nice food for God. If you can do administration, do it unto the Lord. But God can use us where we cannot do things. He did with Gideon, and he can with us. Why? Because it's not about us. We're not an underdog. We're not an underdog. An underdog is someone who wins despite the odds. But if you follow Jesus, then the odds are on your side. Do you see that? God's working through you. You're not an underdog. You're the means through which the most powerful person in the universe works. If God is for us, it says, who can be against us? We're more than conquerors. If we mess up, we know the victory is not dependent on us always being wise or strong or fresh or good at stuff, because it's God that fights. Jesus told his disciples in the book of John, "In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." That's what I got to say about Gideon. But I want to spend a fair amount of time sharing some thoughts on Judges. I don't know how you found this series of four sermons. I've been really troubled by it, as some of you know, because some of you have been good enough to listen to me while I rant. Here are some people, these judges, who are in some cases pretty weak, and in Samson's case, lustful, proud, violent, and odious. And yet God uses them to lead the people. And it got me confused. We're about to start looking for a new leader for the leadership team. Imagine if Samson presented himself. You would hope he wouldn't get nominated. You would hope he wouldn't get appointed. The other judges in the stories we've heard have shown themselves to use deception. And if we'd read on into chapter 8 of Judges for Gideon, he ends up bowing down to an idol. Now, we're used to seeing Old Testament characters as heroes. Noah builds an ark despite the mocking of his neighbors. Daniel carries on praying when ordered not to and ends up in a lion's den. David is described as a man after God's heart. And you think, yeah, okay, these characters mess up, but we see them as people to follow, not with the judges. What's going on? I was confused. And then I spotted something. And to illustrate what I spotted, I'm going to do something unusual. So bear with me. I'm going to play you some music. Any guesses who that is, that rather dour-looking man? That's Shostakovich, very good. He was a Russian composer of the 20th century, lived at the time of Stalin. He fell foul of the Communist parties. He wrote lots of symphonies, these big things to be performed in big concert halls, which, you know, before the age of Instagram and Snapchat is how people, you know, had fun. So they would go to these big concert halls and listen to these symphonies. Now, what the Communist Party wanted, because they still believed, one thinks, that it was a good idea to be communist, is for these symphonies to be full of light and fun and optimism and everything else. And they weren't, because life in the Soviet era in the 1960s was pretty grim. So Shostakovich got into trouble with the Soviet authorities. So what he would do is he'd use his lesser-known works, his chamber music, to express his thoughts and his feelings, because the Communist Party didn't care so much about that. Fewer people listened to string quartets. His eighth string quartet was written in 1960 and is dedicated to the victims of war. There's a violent second movement in there, about as violent as string quartets get, which is said to depict the firebombing of Dresden by the Allies in 1945. The music is bleak, violent, and at times achingly beautiful. It's a phenomenal piece of work. After the service, rush home, listen to it. But throughout, it uses the same four notes, these four notes. Now, D, E flat, C, and B in Russian and German musical notation looks like this. D, E, not flat, but S, C, and B is an H in Russian and German musical notation. And in those four notes, he spells out his initials. And what he's saying by using those four notes is this music is about me. This is what I think. This is what I feel. This is who I am. It becomes very personal. Very personal. There's a story in 1965, the Borodin string quartet, one of the top world string quartets, went to play it to him to get some pointers. As the music went on, his head sunk in his hands and he ended up weeping, and in the end they just left. They didn't know what to do. Because it's so personal, it expresses so many things. I'm going to play you the beginning of three of the movements and you're going to hear as to how this thing works its way through. So listen for those four notes. This is the beginning of the first movement. So you get the idea. The same four notes over and over. This is the beginning of the violent second movement. Listen out for the same four notes. At the end, same four notes. This is the beginning of the third movement. It's the same four notes, and they're interspersed with other stuff in the string quartet. And what Shostakovich is saying is this: in the peace, in the violence, in the jagged parts, I am there. This is who I am. This is what I want to express. The four notes are like a signal in the music pointing to him. It's like his signature. And where I got to with Judges is I started to spot some signals in the book of Judges as well. Hesitate to call it God's signature. That sounds vaguely blasphemous. But some signals within Judges. Because something kind of jumped out at me. And it's the same phrases get used over and over again throughout the book of Judges. Have a look at this. Exactly the same phrase in Judges 3, again in Judges 3, Judges 4, Judges 6, Judges 10, Judges 13. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Exactly the same words. That leads to Judges 3, Judges 4, Judges 6, Judges 13. God sold them into the hands of whoever it was. God delivered them into the hands of whoever it was. Again, it's the same sort of words. That leads to Judges 3, again Judges 3, Judges 13. He raised for them a deliverer. You will have a son, he'll be a deliverer. Which leads to Judges 3, Judges 3, Judges 5, Judges 8. The land had peace for however many years it was, 40 years, 80 years. And then right at the end of Judges, another one. Judges 18, Judges 19, Judges 21. In those days, Israel had no king. And then right at the end, the final verse in the book of Judges, everyone did as they saw fit. And I thought, why is exactly the same language being used? Why is that? It seems too frequent, it seems too weird to be a coincidence. And it seemed to me that in the same way that Shostakovich used the same four notes to say, this is me, this is who I am, this is what I think, so God is using these same phrases to point to something. He's saying, this is my plan. This is who I am. This is me. The Israelites did evil. God cannot abide evil. God is righteous. God will judge. So God sells the Israelites over and again in the hands of their enemies as his judgment on them because of their sin. The Israelites cry out. God relents. He raises a deliverer. The result is peace. But still, the Israelites lack a king. They lack someone to lead them, to show them the right way. Then it struck me, it would be no different now. Human nature hasn't changed. Why aren't we experiencing oppression from our enemies as God's judgment on us? Human nature means that if we enjoy peace, we will turn away from God back to evil, and God must judge, which means no more peace. To restore peace, we need a deliverer in the same way that the Israelites did, who delivers us and brings us peace. But then we turn away again. Here's the thing. The judges in the book of Judges who rescue God's people are variously weak, lying, lustful, proud, faithless, obnoxious, and violent. But that's what humans are like. Not all at the same time, maybe, in different shapes and sizes. Everyone's got their own weak points. What's God pointing to? Well, I think what he's doing is he's pointing to the fact the cycle must continue until in some way he can combine the judgment and the deliverance in the person of a king. The king comes and delivers God's people, but also bears the judgment. The king brings peace, but not peace until the next time God judges, because God has already judged his people. The king has borne the judgment. The king brings everlasting peace. You might call him the Prince of Peace. And his name on earth was Jesus. You're going to hear these words a few times in the coming weeks. In a funny way, this is almost the first of the Christmas sermons. This is from Isaiah 9. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. Who will be the king? He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. You see, Jesus came as a baby at Christmas, but a baby who will deliver God's people and bring peace forever. Not peace until the next time that God's people do evil, because Jesus comes to take the punishment for all evil that God's people do. Think of the presents he was given. He was given gold, the present for a king. He was given frankincense, the present for a priest, for someone who places himself between God and man. And he was given myrrh, the present for someone who will die. There's a weird detail. Look back in Judges 7. There's a weird detail in verse 13. Maybe you didn't notice it as Mike read it. Look at verse 13 of chapter 7. The dream of a Midianite soldier is of a loaf of bread flattening a tent. And you think, why bread? Why not a rock or a weapon or a bolt of lightning or something like that? Well, think on this. The name Bethlehem means house of bread. Jesus was placed in a feeding trough. He called himself the bread of life. He took bread and broke it and said to his disciples, "This is my body broken for you." Why bread? Jesus is there. Jesus is involved in the victory over the Midianites. And here's the thing, if you see Gideon's defeat of the Midianites in that way, if you place Jesus in that story, it does two things. Firstly, it helps us understand the judgment that Jesus bore on the cross. Look at the beginning of chapter 6 again. God is angry because of the sin of the Israelites. God's people are oppressed, they're overrun, and they hide away. On the cross, God was angry at sin. Jesus was oppressed and overrun, but there was nowhere for him to hide. Instead, it says in Isaiah, by oppression and judgment he was taken away, for he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. And on the cross, Jesus defeated Satan and the forces of evil by taking away the punishment for sin that rested on God's people. Look at Judges 7, verse 21. Look at that with me. God's enemies flee, crying out. They still flee at the name of Jesus. Jesus has defeated the forces of evil. So what are we going to make of Judges and of Gideon? God can use us despite our weaknesses. He does so because it's not about us. It's about him and what he achieved through the death of Jesus. We now have a king who brings deliverance and took the punishment that was rightfully ours for the evil we do. And he brings eternal peace for those who will follow him.